Tonight, I want to go in search of sin. That's right, sin. You see, we literal Jews do many things well, like sex, for example. That is to say, we can handle the topic of sex in a relatively open, honest, and I believe, healthy way. Sin, and I have it in my text written with quotes, sin, on the other hand, is a subject that rarely, if ever, comes up in non-Orthodox Jewish settings. It's a word that seems not actually to be in our vocabulary, except if you come during the holy days. And while I love seeing everyone, and whenever you come, you're welcome, I feel bad for you folks that only come during the holy days, because it's so much heavier. Trust us, when you come on Shabbos, we won't talk about sin. A point of fact, I have never in my 13 years as a rabbi here and 5 years as a student rabbi serving a number of congregations, it's actually fun to say where I was, in New Iberia, Louisiana, God love those people, in Jonesboro, Arkansas, Cary, North Carolina, and I spent 2 summers in Alaska. With Laura. And never once in all those years did I ever give one sermon about sin. Of course, there are reasons for our relative silence. For one, the word sin is overdetermined in English, carrying all the weight and connotations of Christian theology. And for Christians, that's fine, but it's challenging for Jews. So original sin, sin is death, sin and salvation through Jesus. That is a significant stumbling block for any Jewish conversation about sin. Another related issue is the challenge of translation. So in Hebrew, the word for sin is chet or chata, which, though translated as sin, is closer to miss the mark, like the root word of an archer who misses the mark. Missing the mark just does not get internalized into the English sense of the word sin. In other words, a Jewish conversation about sin must confront problems with language and theology. I think there's more, however. Our aversion to sin goes much deeper. In the final hour, and this is that final hour, chet, sin, in Hebrew, in English, in any language, is about three things. Relationship, responsibility, and shame. And when that web of connectivity breaks down, the web of connection between relationship, responsibility, and shame, we all suffer. In fact, sin is a painful subject. And any sane person seeks to avoid pain if we can. But in the case of sin, without pain, there is no gain, no hope for what this day is all about, atonement and at-one-ment, reconciliation with the various parts of ourselves that make up who we are. Besides, even if we'd like to talk about the weather, the liturgy is very persistent this time of year, if you haven't noticed. Al chesha chata lifnecha, for these sins before us. Avinu malkeinu chata lifnecha, our Father, our King, we have sinned before you. We just read about all the sins we've done collectively. So even if we wanted to talk about something else, we'd still find ourselves confronting the concept of sin in the Masor, in the prayer book. Our tradition is trying to tell us something. So why not try and understand this message? Let us go together in search of sin. Well, since we're searching, we might as well start in the beginning with the story of Adam and Eve, or what Christianity often refers to as original sin. The story of Adam and Chava, that's Eve's name in Hebrew, and Adam's as well, is actually quite complex and almost universally misunderstood. We won't explore the story in full this evening, but I do have a few questions for you. For one, if God did not want Adam and Chava to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, why did God put the tree in the middle of the garden? Really, why not put it on the side, hide it somewhere? So you can imagine, you know, telling your kids not to do something and then hiding it, but tell your kids not to say eat some candy and then put it on a table in the middle of the room and then leave. What are they going to do? They're going to eat it! Okay, a more important question is, what would life be like if Chava hadn't taken that first bite? Think about this. Boring! Be no life at all. I'm not serious. No desire or yearning, pain or exaltation, true love or lovemaking, and most important of all, no opportunity to become moral beings. It is precisely the fall from the garden, in quotes, that makes life as we understand it possible. We could not be fully human in the garden. Chava, which means mother of all life, gave us life by eating that forbidden fruit. We now should get on our knees and thank Eve for eating the fruit. Judaism more or less rejects the standard reading of the fall. Put that in quotes. Nevertheless, there are a few things we can learn about sin from its study. So remember I said just a few minutes ago that sin was about the matrix between relationship, responsibility, and shame, or regret. The main relationship in the tale is between God and Adam and Chava. Their sin is disobeying God's command. That's pretty obvious. Shame is also central to the tale. What happens after they eat of the apple? The text says God opened their eyes. They could see each other that they were naked, and they went to put clothes on. In other words, they were ashamed. As for responsibility, where they're a little weak on taking responsibility. God has to actually come down, in quotes, to the garden and call them to account. This is from the Torah. Quote, they heard the sound of the Lord God moving around in the garden. I wonder what that sounds like. I bet pretty scary. It would make Jurassic Park seem, you know, very mellow. It's the breezy time of the day, and Adam and Chava hid from the Lord. How do you hide from the ground of all being? The Lord God called out to Adam and said, Ayeka, Ayeka, where are you? Gotta ask a question here. Why does God need to ask Adam where Adam is? The Alter Rebbe, one of the followers of the first Hasidic Rebbe, the Baal Shem Tov, has a great answer. He points out God's not asking Adam where he is for God. God's asking Adam for Adam. Where are you, Adam? Where are you? In other words, what have you done? Ayeka. That's a great question for us on Yom Kippur. Where are we? Are we where we want to be? Ayeka, where are we? So we see this not-so-simple tale of Adam and Eve. So we see in this not-so-simple tale of Adam and Eve the matrix of sin, relationship, responsibility, and shame. The next story that follows Adam and Eve is Cain and Abel. And again, we see the matrix of behavior and consequence. Cain kills Abel. I'm going to move fast to the story. It's another complicated story, by the way. You have to come to Torah study for the full thing. Cain kills Abel, violating, you would say, his relationship with Abel. But also with God, who in this tale is the divine parent. Really, if you read the story, God's like the parent that like leaves two kids in the kitchen with an armed gun in the drawer, and then, oops, something really bad happens. He, Cain, like his biological parents, Adam and Eve, tries to shirk his responsibility. What does he say? Am I my brother's keeper? And once God busts him, he must live with what's called, in quotes, the mark of Cain, nothing less than a metaphor for shame. Relationship, responsibility, and shame. This is the anatomy of sin. Let's see how it applies to our times and our lives. We're going to start with a very difficult subject, even more challenging for us to discuss than sin, but as great a sin as anyone can imagine. And you know what? I know you're not going to want to have to discuss this topic, but I'm sorry, I think we should. It's the subject of torture. Torture is against the Geneva Conventions and international law. Torture is perhaps the starkest example of what happens when the connection between relationship, responsibility, and shame breaks down. The act of torture destroys ordinary social bonds and relationships. The torturer engages in what Harvard professor Elaine Scarry calls the unmaking of civilization. There is no sin greater than the sin of torture. There should be no greater shame than the shame of being party to torture. Yet where is our shame? Where is our cry of anguish, regret, remorse? Where is it? What am I talking about? You're probably saying, I didn't torture anybody. I'm referring to the fact that our government, in our name, is torturing people in Guantanamo, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and in other detention centers we know little about. I read about the accusations of torture by U.S. officials since Abu Ghraib, but it really didn't get to me until I heard the hearings last year for our current Attorney General, who, while willing to call waterboarding morally repugnant, was not willing to describe it as torture or an illegal interrogation method. Do you know what waterboarding is? It's drowning someone over and over again. Right before they drown, you get them out of the water. So there are many ways to do it. One is to tie them on a board, that's why it's called waterboarding, and forcibly pour water in their nose and their mouth until they almost die. Another is to tilt them back into a barrel of water until they almost drown. And there are various other ways it can be done. Do you know when this technique was first discovered, invented? The Spanish Inquisition! And if you Google images, waterboarding, you'll find a nice wood cutting from the 14th, 15th century of some inquisitors. And there's a guy on that board. And the chances are the guy on the board being tortured is a Jewish guy. In fact, there are accounts of Jews who were waterboarded during the Spanish Inquisition, and I'm sparing you the reading of them. And waterboarding, near drowning over and over again, is just one of many abuses, not even disputed by our government. I got physically sick doing the research for this. I was tempted to read some of the transcripts from U.S. interrogation sessions, torture sessions. But I'm going to spare you the details. But lest you question the basic facts that our government is implicated in the torture of detainees, I'll quote retired U.S. Major General Antonio Taguba, who led the Army's investigation into Abu Ghraib prison abuses in 2003. He wrote in a preface to the document submitted to Congress this June, I quote, "There is no longer any doubt that the current administration committed war crimes. The only question is whether those who ordered torture will be held accountable." We don't like the language of sin, but by relinquishing it to others, we allow them to define its meaning in distorted and even dangerous ways. How is it, for example, a sin for a same-sex couple to marry, but not a sin to torture a prisoner, who by our standards, which we're very proud of, is innocent until proven guilty? By the way, according to the Red Cross, 70 to 90% of the detainees at Abu Ghraib were there by mistake. Who knows the story at the other less known or scrutinized facilities in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere? Where's our shame? Where? Al-Khat Shakhatan Alifanafa, for the sin which we have committed before you for averting our eyes. Al-Khat Shakhatan Alifanafa, for the sin which we have committed before you for closing our ears. Al-Khat Shakhatan Alifanafa, for the sin which we have committed before you for the suffering and torture committed on others. Va'al-Khat Shakhatan Alifanafa, for the sin which we have committed before you with our full knowledge or without our knowledge. Va'al kulam eloha slachlanu mechalanu kaparlanu, for all these sins, forgiving God, forgive us, pardon us, grant us atonement. May we also gain the strength, courage, and determination to demand of whoever gets elected president that they stop torture by our hands in our name. You know, regardless of what happens in this election, this is one issue that I think both will want to work on. And I'm thankful for that. For different reasons, I think both candidates are going to want to stop torture in our name. But we need to make sure. We need to make sure. And as you go out, you're going to see there's an interfaith group working on this for the religious community. You can sign up. You can get involved. We can make our voices heard. You know, I wrote this sermon before the financial meltdown we're in the midst of. And you know, I know we all need sanctuary from it, so I'm not going to talk about it. Right? Who doesn't want to hear about it? But I just want to point out that you could not ask for a better illustration of what happens when the matrix of relationship between relationship, responsibility, and shame breaks down. Right? Evil arises, and in this case, in the form of greed, that might bring us all down. I want to now narrow the focus, the lens, from the national scene to our community. And specifically, I want to talk about another very difficult subject, mental health care in Sonoma County. I think what is happening qualifies under my definition of sin, when the connections between relationship, responsibility, and shame break down. Sonoma County's mental health care system has been in the news quite a lot in the last year or so because of what most describe as the collapse of the system altogether. Last June, the county shut down Santa Rosa Psychiatric Emergency Services, the Norton Center, and this February, Santa Rosa Memorial Hospital closed its psychiatric hospital on Fulton. They couldn't afford to keep them open. In addition to the bad news about hospital closures, there have been an alarming number of deadly encounters between Sonoma County law enforcement and the mentally ill. In one incident, a distraught teenager was shot to death. When I mentioned to Laura, who works at Kaiser, who's in healthcare, that I wanted to connect sin to our mental health system, she said, "It's not sin, it's murder. Without the facilities or the resources to care for the mentally ill, more and more of the burden of care falls in places simply not able to cope. Emergency departments, where Laura works, law enforcement, jails, the streets. Murder may seem a little harsh, but in fact, mental illness, if untreated, is deadly." Okay, for many, this is not a personal issue. You have no relationship to or with people suffering with serious mental illness. For others, though, here tonight, this is very personal. You or your loved one has had to go it alone or get shipped out to somewhere else in the greater Bay Area. Either choice is a terror for someone who's already terrified by life. And even if you have the resources, such a dislocation from your home is a severe hardship. Let me tell you a few stories to illustrate my point. These are all true stories. Imagine your elderly father, due to a medication error, has a complete mental breakdown. His only hope for treatment is a facility in San Francisco, but he lives in Santa Rosa. What about his wife for over 50 years? Where will she stay? How will she visit? She doesn't drive anymore. What about the transition home? You just bring them back up, and if there's a problem, you run them back down? It's a long drive. Who's going to drive him? He's not fit to drive. His kids work. This happened to one of our members not too long ago. How about this? Your otherwise healthy teenager starts to hear voices and is soon not safe to himself or his family. The closest facility for him is in Vallejo, if he can get in. Imagine, those of you with children, what do you do? Quit your job and rent a hotel room close? What if you have other kids in your household? What if you can't afford to leave your job? But it's your son. What do you do? This is also a situation very close to our home. Okay, one more example. And this is from Laura, not from me. A colleague of her son is in his early 20s, bright, talented, even has a law degree, but he's also seriously mentally ill. And when he stops taking his medications, he gets sick. So, to make a long story short, he stopped taking his meds and was picked up by the police and thrown in jail. But he's not a criminal. He's mentally ill. What he needs is to get back on his medication. What he needs is to get back on his medication. In jail, he gets sicker and sicker because they can't make him take his medication. And they punish him more and more severely for the violations that he does while he's in jail. You know, we can make the jail a scapegoat. We could also blame law enforcement, but they're not trained mental health professionals. The jail's a jail. It's not a mental health facility. That's precisely the problem. We don't have a facility. But it's your son. What are you going to do? What are we going to do? What can we do? You realize right now, God forbid, someone can have a heart attack and there are three hospitals ready. But if you have a mental breakdown and you need help, there's nowhere to go. Nowhere to go in this county. Hatanu lifanecha, we have sinned before you by not paying attention, by not caring enough about the most vulnerable in our society to do anything to help them. At this point, you might be fairly asking yourself, Rabbi, why did you bring us these huge unsolvable problems? What can we really do to make a difference? I struggle with this. And this is why. These two problems I brought to you because evil flourishes in the dark. Silence is sin's sidekick. Part of being a person of faith is believing that if we shed the light of humanity on a problem, that alone can lead toward a solution. Awareness is the beginning of change. Advocacy is also important. You know, politicians care about public opinion. Our votes do count. Our voices, if we use them, can make a difference. I want to now narrow the focus even more to ourselves, the realm of the personal. Is sin, as I have defined it, meaningful? I think so, because in the end, it's all about relationships with other people, those our government tortures, or the mentally ill, or God. It is from a sense of connectedness that a feeling of responsibility arises. And then, if we blow it, a sense of shame. It's like one of those kinetic sculptures where you drop the ball in one spot, and if all the pieces are connected, the ball moves from one place to another. That connectivity is really the essence of life, as far as I can tell. So let me ask, how connected are we in the congregation, at work, or at home? I ask because when the connections break down, we're more apt to hurt each other. We're more apt to sin. And the truth is, I don't think overall we're very connected. You can live for decades in the neighborhood and not know anything about what your neighbor really cares about. I mean, how many of us really know our neighbors? Can talk about real issues to them? Some, but I don't think very many. How about your coworkers? If you work at Sherman Toro, we know ourselves too well. But otherwise, do you really know your coworkers? What really matters to them? The congregation. We think of ourselves as a chemisha place, a warm, welcoming place. By the way, have you ever met a congregation that thinks that they're really nasty people? It doesn't exist. And I think we are. But how deep are our relationships? I'm proud of Shomrei Torah, and I think the relationships we have are often very thin. I think they could be deeper. That's why we're starting communities and conversations, so we can deepen the relationships we have, find out what people really care about, and then maybe let our voices be heard. And one last question about this. How connected are you to your family? Do you know the emotional map of your children, of your spouse, of your siblings? It's a good time to ask that question. And it's a good time to say, in the new year, I'll do better. How about a relationship with God? Or if you prefer, our higher self. The part of us that demands more than simply what our personal need dictates. The more connected we feel, the more personal responsibility we take, and when that happens, we're more able to hear our own voice of conscience saying, Chatati lifanecha, I have sinned before you. What can I do to fix it? I'd like now to conclude where we began, in search of sin in the Garden of Eden. There we found that sin was bound up in relationship, responsibility, and shame. But life in the garden was no life at all. Thus Eve, who is often seen as the perpetrator of original sin, is actually Chava, the mother of all life. To live is to be in a relationship, and relationships of any kind are a messy business. Failure in one form or another is a given. It's how we respond that's important. Do we allow ourselves to feel shame? Can we take responsibility? Chatanu lifanecha, we have sinned before you. What else is new? The question is, will we recognize it for what it is and do something about it in the year ahead? I want to take a moment now and send blessings of healing to folks in need of healing. I would like everyone to call the names of the people they're thinking about. Just call them out. From the very back all the way up. Everyone, if you're thinking of someone who's in need of healing, just call it the name.
Much needed time for me for deep personal reflection, But every year I get this feeling that washes over me that I'm back with my family. We're all together again, sisters and brothers and cousins and aunts and uncles and nieces and nephews, including all our hundreds of cousins here today who get a little lost in the desert, but they manage to find their way back home here every year. And what truly gives me shivers, whether I'm sitting in the choir or sitting with you, is this vision I get every single year. Thousands of synagogues all over the United States and thousands more all over the world, at this moment or very near this moment, from India to Japan, Algeria to Argentina to Albuquerque to Azerbaijan, Jews and their loved ones all gathering just like we are, reading from the same Torah, singing the same songs, and chanting from the same prayers. And what touches me almost beyond understanding is that layered onto this image is a collective memory of our parents and our grandparents, our great-great-great-grandparents, back thousands of years, gathering at the holy days just like we are in a chain of tradition. This is truly the days of awe. And what is it that binds us and keeps us together through all these years? And I quote from a Jewish journal, the challenges we face are unlike those of any other people. The preservation of a spiritual and cultural heritage. Throughout the ages, it has been the synagogue that stands ever ready to respond to the needs of each and every soul, strengthening our commitment to the task of tikkun midot, the perfection of our inner selves, and tikkun olam, the perfection of God's world. And we feel this at Shomrei Torah, don't we? Our synagogue reaching out its arms to us, a second home for so many of us. Together we have worked so diligently to build this community where we can truly share life's ever-changing cycles, from birth to death, from tears to laughter. True connection can be found in this, our family. It's this level of caring for one another that is so rare to find. It is our utmost priority. This remarkable synagogue has been generously blessed for many years by our beloved Rabbi Gittleman, our learned and compassionate spiritual guide, by Lyra, our extraordinary cantorial soloist, who enhances our prayers through song, and by our very skilled board of directors, and also by our presidents, including Jeremy and those who came before him, who have sacrificed so many hours, hundreds and hundreds of hours of family, work, and personal time to serve us. And most important, literally hundreds of volunteers, you, the members who have donated so much of your time and talent. It is inspiring, and I am humbled by your generosity of spirit. And if that were not enough, we are so fortunate that we have a membership who is financially generous throughout the year. And through the spirit of giving, created the miracle that many of us thought could never happen, and that's our own home on the hill. And to those of you who share the High Holy Days with us, but have not become members yet, we welcome you. We would love to have you join our congregation. We truly feel more whole when you're here with us. Whether your need is spiritual or community or academic, Please be part of this synagogue who has welcomed you so much. Just like you, I was unaffiliated for many years, 18. But every year I did attend Holy Day services like you, no matter where I lived. I finally came home permanently about 16 years ago because I knew it was time for me to take the place in this long chain of tradition with those in the past who gave so willingly of themselves to ensure a place for me, for all of us. If your concerns about joining the synagogue are financial, please know we never turn anyone away for lack of funds. And even if it's not quite the right time for you to join, try out a Friday night service with us. They're lovely. But if the thought of walking into a synagogue, maybe where you don't know anyone, is a little intimidating, I really do understand. It was intimidating for me when I joined a new synagogue in Southern California about 16 years ago. I attended service. I was out of there after I had one cookie at the Onik. And I'm sure some of you know what I'm talking about if you're fairly new to the synagogue. It's a big task to be there and not know anyone. So what you could do about this is to make it easier. Is call the office. If you would like to attend a Friday night service, but you're a little shy about it, call the office and let them know you're coming to services and you would like a buddy. There are so many of us veteran members who would love to welcome you to a service, to sit with you and to introduce you to everybody during the Onik. And that holds true for anyone here who feels a little shy about coming to service. I know even when you're new, a lot of you new members, maybe it would be more comfortable if you knew someone was sitting with you. So remember, just call the office and say you'd like a buddy, and we'll be there. I know Jeremy touched on this issue I'm going to talk about now. None of us like to talk about the subject of money, especially at this most holy of times. But it is so critical to our well-being that we must talk about it. It may be a surprise to you that we now have a $1 million a year budget. And for those of you who have been around a long time, it's pretty hard to believe, isn't it? This money pays for the mortgage, runs the synagogue, pays salaries, subsidizes the religious school, and offers the best programming in Sonoma County. And thanks to our eagle-eyed financial committee, Shomri Torah remains strong, even through these turbulent times. But this does not diminish the need for the extra dollars required to cover ever-rising expenses. We are projecting a $35,000 deficit in our budget this year. That's a lot of money. And it can only be covered through the continued generosity of all of you, us here today. We are painfully aware of the economic challenges today. Each and one, every one of us has been affected by what's happening. I know we, David and I, decided to postpone our retirement indefinitely. However, that's not serious compared to what's happening to members of this synagogue and many other Jewish synagogues in the area and probably the country. They have been hit with devastation, loss of jobs, possible loss of homes, and are having trouble making their monthly payments, bill payments. These members cannot be asked to stretch more. But as their family, we must stretch for them. According to Jewish tradition, those of us who can must show our gratitude for our good fortune and give more. What I am about to ask is difficult, and that is that those of us who can give more must give more. To ensure that Shomrei Torah continues to be financially strong. I'm asking those of you who can stretch to do so tonight and tomorrow, this coming week. Please make an additional pledge of $50, $100, $200, $500, whatever you can over the year. And believe me, it is much easier for you to write the check than for me to stand up here in front of 800 people and make that ask. Several weeks ago, David and I filled out that form we all receive in the mail, and we have to we check off how much we'd like to give for a High Holy Day donation. But we've made the commitment that tonight we are going to use this envelope to make an additional High Holy Day pledge. David is not Jewish, and we have no children, and I might add, we're not wealthy at all, but we are both committed to the values of Judaism, to Shomrei Torah, and to this family here today. To all our collective children and grandchildren who will be here 10, 20, 50 years from now, who will be reading from the same Torah, singing the same melodies, and chanting the same prayers. It's why we plant the seeds we do for the next generation to reap the rewards and to taste its fruit. So please, on your way out tonight after the service, you will see several choir members who will be distributing these envelopes. And please fill them out tonight and bring them tomorrow or mail them in during the week. In conclusion, as Sylvia Borstein, a spiritual teacher to many of us, has just said recently, at this holiest time of year, it's like each of us has been given a pencil, sharpened pencil, and a brand new clean notebook in which to write our script. It's our script for the year, it's our legacy. Let's begin our first chapter with generosity. Thank you, Bud Yontov, and may you have an easy fast.
We're on page 782, I'm sorry, 282, for Alenu. Please rise.